If you would open up to Psalm 39, Psalm 39. Hope you'll indulge me for a minute. I'm going to tell you four applications real quickly. They're all going to share a similarity. Looking good. But they're all going to come from something that's different about each of them. And I want you to tell me about what the difference is rather than the similarity. Four different situations. First one, perhaps a friend has a drastic car accident. They've survived the accident, so many staples that it nearly looks like they have a zipper on their body. And you come into the hospital room and you say, "Boy, you look good." Maybe another situation where a family is grieving. And at the visitation, as you come through the line, they might say about their loved one who is in the casket, "Don't they look good?" Maybe you get into other scenarios. Maybe you see a grandchild getting dressed to go out on a date with another Christian young man or young woman. And you say, "Wow, you look good." Or even another, maybe you see a friend that you haven't seen in several years from out of town, and they come in and they've perhaps even lost some weight, picked up some muscle, and you go, "Wow, you look good." Similarities, you can tell, are all there. Look good. What's so drastically different? Okay. Let's just assume they're trying to be honest, at least. Circumstances, situations, right? You can have the exact same words going on, but if the situation or the context is different, it can be something that goes from being sarcastic about how good somebody looks when they know they don't look that great after a near-fatal car accident, or some people who are grieving who talk about their loved one that they look good, even though that they know that, man, this is really tough. And even sometimes the shock and the surprise of someone, "Hey, I haven't seen you in forever. Boy, you look good." And then even someone who, you know, just think in terms of just a general thought of, here's a grandchild getting ready to go out and have fun with another Christian, and to go, "Boy, you kind of cleaned yourself up," we might say. "You look good." And realize, we talk about it often, about context really does change the way that verses come out at us. And to understand, in Psalm 39, if you don't understand the context of what's going on here, you might form and think Psalm 39 is saying something that it's not. So, I know we say it all the time. We've got to be careful with context when you look at scriptures. But just in the same way of just saying, "Boy, somebody looks good," can have so many different contexts and so many different situations, and sometimes it can be genuine, and sometimes it can be sarcastic, and sometimes it can be funny, sometimes it can be a surprise. But you realize, when you look here at Psalm 39, I want you to look at the very beginning. I want you to look before verse 1, if you have a heading. Not the topical statement, but a heading. Look at what it says. Psalm 39 says, "For the choir director, for Jeduthun, a psalm of David." So who do you know wrote it? David wrote it. But then it says, "For the choir director, for Jeduthun." Who or what is Jeduthun? All right. He says, "For the choir director," and then it says, "For Jeduthun." You think it has a bearing? It really does. Now, Jeduthun literally means praise. That's the literal meaning of that name, and it is a name. I thought about spending some time and going and looking through these things a lot more, but I decided against it just because of the time. If you're a note taker, let me give you a few things to write down. 1 Chronicles chapter 16. verses 37 through 43, specifically talks about Jeduthun, which actually comes from a Hebrew name, Yada. Anybody ever said that to you? Yada. Sometimes people say, yada, yada, yada. Well, it literally means praise, 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 praise. They may not even know that, but that's what the Hebrew word literally means. And so the idea carries with it praise, to confess, to say the same thing as someone else, or even to give thanks. Now, that gives you a little idea. Jeduthun's actually a man, and he, alongside Asaph and Heman, are basically the leaders of the singers. And in being leaders, they're commissioned whenever David, if you remember, whenever he had to move the Ark of the Covenant from the house of Obed-Edom after Uzzah had been struck dead. At that point in time, David commissions these men as singers. Jeduthun is really a harp player. And in doing that, his sons, he has six sons, and they actually are gatekeepers at the tabernacle that's now, at that point in time, is in Gibeon. Remember, the temple doesn't come around until the days of Solomon. Jeduthun is there on opening ceremonies with that as well over in 2 Chronicles chapter 5. In going through their job, Jeduthun and his sons are to give praise to God, specifically about for the loving kindness of who God is. Now, in seeing these things together, there was also an aspect of to give thanks to the Lord. Then if you want to take another jot, you can jot down 1 Chronicles chapter 25, verses 1 through 5. Says some very similar things, but adds in another aspect. He says, Jeduthun plays the harp, and you think about, for David and Jeduthun, they shared this in common. So you can understand why David would write a psalm just for Jeduthun. And there's actually other psalms that are written for Jeduthun as well, in terms of Psalm 62, Psalm 77. They're wonderful psalms. And yet, to go through and understand, here they are to be trained in singing. Now, here's the situation of Psalm 39. This psalm is specifically for Jeduthun. It is for his sons. That as people come up to worship God at the tabernacle in Gibeon, later on going to be, in Solomon's day, to be the temple that's going to be in Jerusalem, they actually sing these hymns, these psalms, as people come and go out of the tabernacle. Now, can you imagine going back to the Old Testament times, as you walked into the tabernacle, later on, into the temple, that there would actually be singers that would be there who would be playing and singing these psalms as you walked in. Now, I want you to think about how much of an effect hearing the same things over and over again has on you. Now, I'm going to use this as an illustration. I know this isn't the most spiritual illustration, but I'm going to use it anyway. Have you ever walked into Menards? Can you think of any slogans or jingles that they play while you're there? And then whenever they advertise on TV, can you think of what little jingles that are always there? And then whenever you leave the store, you find yourself humming, "Save big money at Menards." And you think, how did that get stuck in my head? Now, I'm using that as an illustration to show you, even just very little exposure leaves an effect on you, right? So what if there were songs that you associated with just going to the tabernacle, that you associated with later on in future generations going to the temple? These are the kind of things that would stick to your head and in your brain whenever you have been there for a while and then you leave. And all of a sudden, as you're going home, you're still singing or humming these hymns in your head. Because they actually did have a tune to them. It's not known to us. But for them. Now, I want you to think about that. I want you to just kind of listen. You can follow along and read it as we go through it. But I want you to just listen to these 13 verses. And I want you to tell me what really sticks out to you. If you were a worshiper in Israel, you were coming into the tabernacle, later on into the temple, and this is what's being sung as you come in and as you go out and while you're there. And there was more than just one hymn. Don't think this was the one and only one. But this was one among a few. Just listen to these verses and tell me what you would pull out of them. What would really kind of grab your attention? I said, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle while the wicked are in my presence. I was mute and silent. I refrained even from good, and my sorrow grew worse. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue. Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the extent of my days? Let me know how transient I am. Behold, you have made my days as handbreadths, and my lifetime is nothing in your sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath, Selah. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. And now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in you. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. I have become mute. I do not open my mouth, because it is you who have done it. Remove your plague from me. Because of the opposition of your hand, I am perishing. With reproofs you chasten a man for iniquity. You consume as a moth what is precious to him. Surely every man is a mere breath, Selah. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with you, a sojourner like all my fathers. Turn your gaze away from me, that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. What sticks out to you? You're but a breath. What else? My hope is in you. What else hit you? Short lifetime, short lifespan. Oh, I'll keep my mouth shut. You notice there's a lot of things in here, right? And don't worry, we're not going to read it 50 times while we're here tonight. But to go, you start to notice the more times you would read through it, the more familiar you became with it, the more different aspects of it would stick with you, right? Just like in the same way, maybe whenever you listen to a song, whether it's new or familiar, sometimes you walk away and you remember the tune of it, but you might not be thinking of what is that lyric that's there? Then the next time you come into the tabernacle, oh, that's the word. Oh, yeah. So whenever you start looking through here, can you understand just on the front side here, and we'll hit it again on the back side, why would David write this down? And Asaph, Haman, and Jeduthun were all under the king's instruction. And it just so happens that the king is who? David. Here's the instruction that David gives. I'm going to write this for you, and I want you to sing it to people as they come and go. Since Jeduthun and his son also keep gates, as well as being singers, well-skilled singers. Each of his six sons actually has a section of time that they fill in rotation. There's 24 different rotations. Each of his six sons shares in one of those. So this is something that was a very familiar psalm to them. You may be thinking, I don't know that I've read this psalm before in my life. To them, this is something they knew like the back of their hand over time. Now, here they are. Look at verse 1. Let's see if we can figure out, why did David want this to be something that is shared every time there were people would come and go? He said, verse 1. I said, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle while the wicked are in my presence. What is David aware of? Tongue can get out of control. What New Testament chapter does that remind you of? Anybody think about James chapter 3, tongues of fire? Well, fire can either be good or good fire can be bad. Depends on whether it's controlled, then it's good. If it's out of control, what happens? It devours everything in its path. So you realize, here's David. Man, I'm going to guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. Because I better be careful. You think it's important to think about that when you come into the presence of God? I better be careful with my tongue. And I better be careful with my ways. Because it's pretty easy to sin with my tongue. He says, I'll guard my mouth as with a muzzle. When do you typically use a muzzle? All right, someone to be silent. Think about it with a dog. And that's the way we think of it. For them, probably more like livestock from eating something they shouldn't. He says, I'll guard my mouth as with a muzzle. In other words, I'd rather say nothing at all rather than to say something wrong. Do we ever feel that way? It'd be better for me to say nothing than to say the wrong thing. He says, while the wicked are in my presence. Now he shapes it a little different. What kind of context are we really dealing with here? Right. And you think through, think in terms of this. You're going up to the tabernacle. Were there even wicked people among Israel? Yes. Now, he says, even whenever I get in front of my wicked people, he says, or the wicked people, he says, I get real careful with my mouth. Like to the point where I don't say anything. I'm muzzled because I'm afraid I'm going to sin. But I want you to see the next aspect of this. Look at verse 2. He says, I was mute and silent. I refrained even from good, and my sorrow grew worse. Just whenever you start to muzzle everything down where you don't say anything at all, he says, mute and silent. You think, that doesn't sound like there's hardly anything being said, mute and silent. But notice what's not being taken advantage of now. Even taking opportunities to share something that's good. Sometimes when we get ourselves in enough trouble, we go, you know what, it'd be probably just be better if I never said another thing for the rest of my life. But then if you take that reproach, can you ever encourage anybody? Can you ever give a helpful answer when it's needed? In a moment of need? No. So here's David saying, you can swing the pendulum one way and go, well, you know what, I'm just never going to say anything. I'll muzzle my mouth whenever it comes in the presence of the wicked. He says, but then at the same time, there's opportunities to do good, and if I'm mute and silent, I'm not going to take advantage of those either. I think if we've lived long enough, we see those times in life of going, there are times where we say things and we go, I shouldn't have said that. You also have times where you go, I could have said something and it probably would have been beneficial. It goes both ways, doesn't it? Now, he says, and my sorrow grew worse. Whenever you just go silent, what happens? Just got worse. Because now I'm not taking advantage of opportunities for what's good. I may be spared from stepping off into sin, but I'm not helping either. So, looky here as he says. He says, my sorrow grew worse. Verse 3. He says, my heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Now, whenever you start to consider what he's saying here, he says, my heart grew hot. What does that mean to you? You're very kind. Agitated. He's angry. I mean, he is angry. He's disturbed. I mean, he's incensed is probably the way we would think of it, of going, he is so angry because all of a sudden you start to realize I'm not failing and I'm not succeeding either. So maybe I really am failing. Then he says, my heart was hot within me. He says, while I was musing, the fire burned. What does musing mean? Yeah, a contemplation, a thinking, you're all kind of absorbed in thought to go, and the more I thought about it, the worse it got. He says, I just got hotter. Until notice what he's going to do next. What does he do? It's time to talk. Right? He says, I can't keep this in anymore. He says, then I spoke with my tongue. And notice who he addresses. Verse 4. Lord. How's it typed? All caps. So what do you know? What kind of name is this? This is God's covenant name, right? Yahweh or Jehovah. Now, he says, Lord, make me to know my end. And what is the extent of my days? Let me know how transient I am. He says, Lord, how long? Do we ever think that way? How much longer am I going to be here? Sometimes, how much longer am I going to have to endure this? Right? Now, I want you to think about the way we typically view time. When things are going really, really well, how do we feel about lifespan? We go, man, I could do this forever. Whenever things get really, really difficult and hard, what do we think about lifespan? Time never passes quick enough, does it? Now, look at where he's at. It's telling you a mindset, and now here it's going to come out. He says, I'm going to open my mouth. He says, I'm going to speak with my tongue. He says, Lord, make me to know my days. And what is the extent of my days? Let me know how transient I am. Now, what's the assumption in verse 4? What is David assuming by what he's saying? What does God know? He knows how many days. He knows the length of time that's left in his lifespan. That's why over in Psalm 139, what's David talk about? You know my days before there was even one. You ordained them. You wrote them down in your book. At this point, though, he's saying, Lord, would you tell me? Now, I want you to stop and think about that for a second. If you knew that God could write down on a piece of paper the days that are ordained for your life, from first to last, would you want to see that number? It's kind of a mixed bag question, isn't it? Let's make it just a little bit more tumultuous. Would you want to see it for your mate? It becomes a little bit different question, doesn't it? Now, here's David. So will you tell me how long? You know. I don't. But you know. He says, what is the extent of my days? Let me know how transient, how short my life is, how short I am. David's really not going to live to be an old, old man. I mean, he serves as king for about 40 years. And he's not really old when he becomes king. Even if he's in his 20s, he's not living to 70. And to go, would you let me know my days? Let me know how brief my days are. Verse 5. He says, behold, you have made my days as handbreadths, and my lifetime is nothing in your sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath. Think about what he says. You have made my days as a handbreadth. I mean, the span of a hand. He says, to you, God, nothing. I mean, I want you to notice, is that the way we measure each other's height? We go, well, let's see how many spans you are. Some people do that with horses, but to go, we don't do that because it'd take too much time and effort, right? He says, yet with God, he says, I'm pretty small compared to this. Do you think that's a realization we need to have when we come before God? How small our time is compared to His? Whenever we don't understand why things are going the way that they're going, of going, you know, God, you know I don't. I'm just a very short breath compared to who you are. Now, he makes another statement here. He says, and my lifetime is nothing in your sight. I mean, to consider a lifetime even of 70 years, we go, that's pretty significant. You know, 80 years, wow. Even beyond. And to go, yet with God, it's not very much. Then, he says, surely every man at his best is a mere breath. Now, what verse out of James are you thinking of now? Life is like a vapor. Not all vapors smell the same, though, do they? Some are very pleasant, some are very crude. You go, which way is our life? Are we a sweet aroma to God? Or are we an abomination and a stench to God? A vapor is still a vapor. It's only going to last for a little while. And then he uses this word, Selah, which of course carries with it kind of that idea. It literally means to pause, but really it carries with it, pause and think about it. I think about it in terms of like music of a repeat, like maybe you ought to read that last thought again and dwell on it. Really not very much compared to who God is in terms of length. Then verse 6, surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. He says, look at how limited we are. He says, we work, yet we don't know who's going to end up with it in the end. We don't know whether our children will outlive us or not. We don't know any of these things. But at the same time, to go, but you know. He says, and sometimes people get enraged about things that don't even matter. How often do you see that? He comes all the way through these things together to really now come to verse 7. And I really want you to consider these things. And now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in you. And look real closely at verse 7. Notice it doesn't say, for who do I wait? It says, and now, Lord, for what do I wait? Why does he say that? For what do I wait? Let's make it a little bit more colloquial. What are you waiting for? He says, if you know that your life is just a handbreadth, if you know that your life is just a vapor, if you know that sin is around every corner in terms of whether you're going to be utterly silent or whether you're going to just not encourage other people. He says, what are you waiting for? Oh, you mean it's time for me to come to my senses? You mean I've come into the tabernacle of God or later on the temple of God? And I need to be thinking about how short my life is compared to who God is. I need to be thinking about, is there sin that's part of me whenever I come into your presence? What am I waiting for? What am I waiting for to change? Let me show you a New Testament parallel. We're going to come back. Look over at Luke chapter 15. Luke chapter 15. I know you're familiar with this story probably. I just want to pluck about 3 or 4 verses out of it. Luke chapter 15, look down at verse 17. The story is one that we typically know of as the prodigal son, even though prodigal doesn't show up in the scripture, meaning wasteful. Yet, father has 2 sons. One of the sons says, give me my inheritance. I wish you were dead. Can I have my money? And he goes off and he starts to squander it all. And it gets so bad that he desires to eat what the pigs are eating, which tells you he's off in a Gentile country, because Jews don't do that. Unclean food, what could they do with it? But verse 17, but when he came to his senses, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I am dying here with hunger? What did he come to? What's he waiting for? What's he waiting for? It has to get so bad that he's eating the pig slop. He's eating the carob pods. And I bet if you saw one, you probably wouldn't go, I wonder what that tastes like. What's he waiting for? Then, verse 18, he says, I will get up and go to my father and will say to him, he prepares his speech, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. Don't take me back as a son. Can I be a slave? He says, will you take me back? Then verse 20. What's he waiting for? So he got up and came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. What was the father waiting for? For his son to come to his senses. What do you think David's trying to get people to do way back there in Psalm 39 when they come to the tabernacle? Are you going to come to your senses? Or are you just going to stay in your sin? He says, do you realize you're dealing with the eternal God? And you only have a few breaths in your whole lifespan? He says, are you ready to come to your senses? What are you waiting for? You think in terms of 1 John chapter 1. Very specifically, John's talking about walking in the light and someone who has realized their sin. And you get this promise that's there that John writes down for us. And he says, if we confess our sins, he is righteous and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. What is ever available after we come into Christ? Forgiveness. So often we're walking down the wrong path, and what is God saying? What are you waiting for? You know my promise is here. You know if you agree with me on what you did was wrong and you confess your sin, what do you know my response will always be? I'm faithful, I'm righteous. And not only does he forgive us, he says, and I will cleanse you from all unrighteousness. If we're cleansed from all unrighteousness, what's left? Righteousness, only what's good. The only question is, when are we going to come to our senses? Here's God saying, I got it right here in the blood of my son. What are you waiting for? Now, do you understand why David wants people to think about that whenever they come and go? That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Now, come back over to Psalm 39. So verse 7 continues on. He says, and now, Lord, he says, for what do I wait? My hope is in you. My hope is you. What's the hope? What will God give? Won't he grant forgiveness? Now, for those going into the tabernacle, they didn't have the Lamb of God like we do. What did they have? They had the law. And if they committed a sin with their mouth, then what do they have to offer? A sacrifice, an animal. To bring in an unblemished, unspotted animal and to come to the altar and to confess their sin like a trespass offering. And saying to God, what I did against my neighbor is my fault. And I confess that sin, and I put my hand on the head of that animal, and that animal now becomes my sin. And me as the worshiper, what do I have to do next? Now I have to take the knife and slit its throat. And that animal is going to die from two things. Number one, loss of blood. Number two, it can't breathe. Exact same two things that Jesus dies from as the Lamb of God. I come and I go, man, I'm real squeamish. I don't know, do you want fellowship with God or not? You ready to come to your senses? Or are you going to keep on walking in sin? Even though you come into the tabernacle or later on into the temple, or for us, we come in to worship God, and we still have this animosity against our brother or sister. We can't say kind words with our mouth. We get angry. When are we going to come to our senses? What are we waiting for? Don't we realize that our life is brief and short? Is your hope really in God? Because if it is, you know where to find forgiveness. We sing some songs kind of like that. What will you do with Jesus? What will you do with Jesus, my friend? Neutral you cannot be. Someday your heart will be asking, oh God, what will He do with me? We sing that, don't we? We really think about it. Now, he says, now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in you. Verse 8. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. Notice, this is a picture of someone coming into the tabernacle of the temple offering up a trespass offering. I come here because I have sin that needs to be atoned for. He says, deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. Don't let people just make fun of me for my stupidity. Verse 9, I have become mute. I do not open my mouth because it is you who have done it. You ever feel so guilty you know you can't say a word? There's another story that Jesus tells about someone throwing a wedding banquet. And the original guests won't come. And so they go out and they invite everybody they can think of, the slaves do. And then whenever everybody shows up, they're eating at this feast. And there's one person there who doesn't have on the wedding clothes. Don't you know that the host of the wedding feast gives the clothes? Here's someone who's just rebellious. They wouldn't put them on. And it says that whenever he was asked, why don't you wear the wedding clothes? Remember what he said? He didn't say a word. What can you say? I knew better. I just didn't do it. He says, I don't have any words. Now, he says, I have become mute. I do not open my mouth because it is you who have done it. He says, you have held me guilty for what I've done. Is that a just God? Certainly. Yet is He a God of grace who offers forgiveness? Yes. When you come to your senses. Verse 10. He says, remove your plague from me. Because of the opposition of your hand, I am perishing. You realize where these things are coming from? Who are we standing in opposition to in our sin, in our trespasses? Standing in opposition to God. And His hand is heavy. Because He can measure the universe by the span of His hand. Now, He says, remove your plague from me. I know you sent it. Verse 11. With reproofs you chasten a man for iniquity. With reproofs you chasten a man for iniquity. You consume as a moth what is precious to him. He says, this is here because of my guilt. Isn't that what iniquity is? He says, I know what got me here. It's me. And now I've come to my senses. I've come to bow down before you with a humble and contrite heart. And what is found? Sweet mercy and forgiveness. He says, you consume as a moth what is precious to him. Ever been really intimidated by a moth? I hope not. He can't do anything to you, by the way, other than land on you. Think about, what does the moth do? When do you know the moth has attacked you? When you take those old clothes out of the back of the closet. I'm just now getting old enough to where that can happen. You pull that thing out and you go, man, this used to be crap. Hey, what happened? The moth got a hold of it. Huh. All of a sudden, God is hitting you in places that you weren't even aware of. And hitting you in places of things that were valuable to you, and now you see how worthless they really are. He says, you consume as a moth what is precious to him. Surely every man is a mere breath. He comes back to it, short-lived. Selah, think about it. Think about it again. Verse 12. Here really is. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Notice how he uses Lord again. He says, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with you, a sojourner like all my fathers. He says, God of the covenant, Jehovah God. He says, hear my prayer. I'm coming to offer my offering, my trespass offering. He says, do not be silent at my tears. Sometimes there are tears shed because we got caught. Sometimes there are tears shed because we know what we did was utterly stupid and foolish and rebellious against God. Those tears don't seem to stop so quickly. Then he says, don't be silent at my tears. And actually in Psalm 56, it talks about that God has our tears in a bottle. That tells you how intimately acquainted with us he is. He says, for I am a stranger with you, a sojourner like all my fathers. He says, I don't have the closeness with you. I feel myself being far away, and I know I'm the one who's done it. I know it's my fault, not yours. I've come to my senses, and I've come to you. Then he says in verse 13, turn your gaze away from me that I may smile again. This is not a gaze of joy. This is the idea of wrath. Turn your wrath away from me. Turn vengeance away from me. He says that I may smile again, that I may be cheerful and happy. Sometimes we wonder, how come people aren't happy? It's hard to be happy in guilt. He says, it's impossible. He says, before I depart and am no more, because I'm just a short, brief life. Can you understand why this is what David wanted those singers to sing as people would come in and go out of the tabernacle in the temple? Do you understand why it's important to be thought of to know there is an answer for your problem if you'll just come to your senses? What are you waiting for? God's grace is right here. And now for us, we find all that in Jesus. All right. Lord, we're going to come back next week. Psalm 40. Have a good week.